Welcome back to Toys on Tap. This week is a little bit different, but we're so excited. Richard C. Levy comes on the podcast, who is a toy inventor from back in the day, did toy fairs, had his hand in corporate American toy worlds and all that stuff, and is, in my opinion, one of my favorite people because he had his hand in making of the Furby. If you want more Toys on Tap, you can like, follow, rate, review wherever you get podcasts. You can jump on all socials at Toys on Tap, and you can jump on the Patreon to support us a little bit, patreon.com/toys on tap. For $3 a month, you get extra content, and it is absolutely amazing. Now let's get to this Furby creator's life on this week's episode of Toys on Tap. There is so many questions I have for you and so many things I want to talk to you about, but I'll kind of just lay out what Toys on Tap is before we start. Toys on Tap is a podcast that deals with people that are independent artists that use toys as their medium. So I have all kinds of stuff behind me, people like Frank Kozik, who did designer toys and stuff, and all kinds of people. And every once in a while, I get to bring on people like yourself or people in the toy industry that kind of rock the house on a different level. And so that's where getting in touch with you was awesome, because you had your hands on one of my favorite toys of all time. And so I kind of want to walk through your life a little bit, and maybe we'll settle somewhere around that toy and we'll get going.
I'm happy to do it.
Oh, you're such a blessing. You're such a blessing. But yeah, so welcome to Toys on Tap. Before we start anything, please introduce yourself. Tell us who you are and what you do.
Okay, my name is Richard C. Levy, and today I'm an independent toy inventor, having gone through several careers. I landed here and I love it.
It's amazing. From what I can gather, and from what I know about your history, you haven't always been in toys. You've kind of dabbled in what I think movies, commercials, publishing, all of those things.
And television.
So can you walk me back to where we started and how we ended up in toys?
Sure, I'm happy to. And jump in whenever you have a question. In fact, my nephew was just here and I was telling him about how I got into feature films. But anyway, I had a grandmother who was, and my grandmother and grandfather were both in international businesses. My my grandfather was vice president of Tootsie Rolls and Chunky chocolate. He brought Kit Kats to America from England, actually. And my grandmother was an haute couture. She went to all the shows every year. She made over 80 crossings of the Atlantic in her life. She'd go to Milan and Paris and London or whatever. And one day she said to me, when I pass away, I didn't even know what she was talking about. I was so young, but she says, yeah, I probably won't leave you any money because you see how I live, but I will leave you educated. And she was my best friend. She and my mom were my best friends. Mm-hmm. And Nana, I lived 3 summers in Spain, 3 months each summer as a kid, you know, growing up, yeah, 2 summers in France, and 1 summer running around Italy.
Wow.
My grandmother's dentist was in Italy because she didn't trust American dentists, because back in the day, the Italian dentists were physicians who then specialized in dentistry. And she said, if something goes wrong in the chair, I want a physician there. Mm. Anyway, she was into this. So my junior summer, I went to Emerson College. I was a television and film major. This is an interesting story. My whole life has been one of like stumbling into things.
Yeah, I love it.
My mother said to me when it came time for college, she said, well, why don't you go to Emerson College, which was her alma mater. She, in her class, was Norman Lear was in her class.
Wow.
A whole lot of famous people, producers, directors. My class was Henry Winkler. The Fonz was in my class, Vin DeBona, America's Funniest Home Videos, a lot of these Hollywood guys. Anyway, so go up there. So I apply to Emerson College in Boston. And she said to me, you can go to college anywhere you want as long as it's in Boston. because it's such a great place to go to school.
Yeah.
So sure. So I'm standing in line at the registrar and she says to me, "What's your major?" And I went, "Languages. I speak 5 foreign languages." Mm. And she goes, "Well, not at Emerson College. You don't." I said, "What do you mean?" She says, "We don't have a major in languages, but you're a communication school." "Yeah, that's true. But we don't have foreign language. We just don't have it. So we would have to set up something at Boston University or somewhere else for you." I tapped the guy behind me and I said, "What are you majoring in?" He goes, "Bro." I looked at Mrs. Frazier and I said, "Bro?" She goes, "Oh, that works." Okay. So can I change? She says, "Hey, you can change. You got 2 years, whatever." I said, "Okay, fine." So now we get outside and I looked at this kid. His name was Jimmy Kahn. He went to Hollywood. He was the director out on soap operas and stuff. Hmm. I said, "What's bro?" He says, "Broadcasting." I said, "What's that?" He goes, "Well, television, film, and radio." I said, "Okay." That's how I got going on my career in television and film, just through a fluke.
Yeah, just stumbling on it.
Just stumbled into it. Now it's my junior summer. My uncle was a Broadway producer, and he got me a job with, he helped me get a job with Paramount Pictures in Spain because I was living there over the summers. So now it's the end of the summer. I come home and it's like October. And mother says to me, "What are you going to do when you graduate?" And I said, "I don't know." She says, "Well, how'd you do at Paramount in Madrid?" I said, "Oh, I think I did pretty well. They liked me, you know, it was a good job. I made $50 a week."
Yeah.
She says, "Okay, we'll call the president of Paramount." Now, today, no one picks up phones in companies.
Right.
But this is 1967, 68, right? Mm-hmm. She says, "Well, pick up the phone and call the president of Paramount. Tell him you need a job." Okay. So I picked up the phone. I called Henri Michaud, who was the president of Paramount International at 1501 Broadway in New York. And the secretary says, "Who's calling?" And I said, "Richard Levy." He doesn't know me, but he gets on the phone. He says, "Tell him I worked in the Madrid office over the summer." Mm-hmm. So he gets on the phone. He says, "Young man, what can I do for you?" And I said, "Well," I said, "I really had a great time in the Madrid office over the summer. Thank you so much." And he said, "Well, I heard you did a fabulous job." I said, "Well, that's very nice." He says, "So what can I do for you?" I said, "I'm going to need a job in June when I graduate." And he goes, "You're going to work for me."
Oh, my gosh.
I said, "Can you imagine going in and working for the president?" I said, "I'm going to train you." "Terrific." I said, "By the way, I'm going to make Dean's List." He goes, "Just get the sheepskin and come to New York." When you graduate. I didn't even know what a sheepskin was, to be honest with you. I had to figure that out afterwards.
Yeah.
So I went to New York in early June that year. I never asked what my salary was. I never asked what my vacation time was. I never asked anything. I just showed up. And it was 2 or 3 days later that the executive vice president called me and told me what I was going to be paid. Mm-hmm. And they put me in every single department. I did marketing. I did advertising. I did all these things in the headquarters building. And one of the lessons I learned, I learned a lot of stuff there. This was working for Paramount was like a PhD in showmanship and shtick.
Yeah.
Promoting feature films. I worked on Rosemary's Baby, The Odd Couple. I mean, just Barbarella, a whole bunch of them.
Wow.
And, so now he calls, he says, "Do me a favor, go into my conference room and set it up." I said, "Okay." So I go and I put down the legal pads and everything else. And I come back and he said, "Are we all set?" I said, "Yeah, but there's a major problem with your conference room. You could turn to Queen Mary in this conference room." He said, "What's the problem?" I said, "There are no chairs. Somebody took the chairs out of your conference room." He goes, "Close the door. I'm about to teach you a lesson in management." Mm. I said, "Okay." Close the door. "So what's the story?" He goes, "I took the chairs out." I said, "Wait a minute. You took the chairs out of your conference room? Why?" He goes, "Here's a lesson for you, Richard. Never let them get comfortable." How interesting is that?
Yeah.
Because in those days, they had cigarette, you know, ashtrays on the tables and everything else. And he said, because they're going to come in with their cigarette, they're going to be getting their shoes shined. We used to have a shoe shine guy who used to run around shining shoes, having their coffee. He says, I run my meetings. I stand at the end of the table. They stand and watch how fast it gets done. That was one of the crazy lessons I learned. It was interesting. Anyway, so then I'm there for I don't know how many months. And then he sent me to Philadelphia to learn how a domestic operation worked.
Yeah.
And I worked in the Philadelphia office for a while. And then he calls me in and he says, I'm sending you to Panama. Panama, Central America. Mm-hmm. I want to know what's going on. You're going to be my eyes and ears. What's going on down there? And there's always something off. Costa Rica, Guatemala, Nicaragua, Salvador. In those days, British Honduras. Today it's called Belize. Mm-hmm. In those days, Belize was the capital city and British Honduras was the country. Mm. They sent me down to Panama and I worked in Panama.
Meet Chum, the adorably deadly hammerhead shark creation from Pocket Salsa and Toys on Tap that has come from the depths to join your toy shelf.
Shark! Take it out of the water! Shark!
He can be found in the wild later this year in several different blank colors, and in some cases, rarer painted versions of Chum can be found. This chubby little guy comes in at 4 inches tall with one point of articulation.
You're gonna need a bigger boat.
He is the perfect mix of cute and deadly.
I am never going back in the water.
Don't miss out on your chance to capture one of these little guys before they're gone.
So one day, I'm at one of my premieres. I was always in the newspapers premiering motion pictures. And he said to me, a guy comes over to me with a badge. Mm-hmm. Flat badge. He says, are you Richard Levy? And I said, yes. Yeah. What do you do? This is in front of the Opera Theater on Via España in Panama. I said, well, I run advertising, publicity, marketing, shtick, you know, for Panama and Central America, for Paramount. He goes, you're not an engineer who fixes carbon arc projectors? I said, with all respect, I don't know what you're talking about. He says, your work papers, you know, we have open borders in our country. We don't care who comes in. It doesn't matter. Taking jobs, yeah. It doesn't matter. Panamanians, sovereign nation. They said, we only let you come here to work because you could fix carbon arc projectors. And we don't have anybody in the country of Panama that fixes carbon arc projectors. But if you're talking marketing, advertising, publicity, we got a lot of people. So we're deporting you. I said, what? He says, tomorrow morning, you and your wife are on a plane out of here. So I showed up in my boss's office the next day. Young man, what are you doing here? I said, I was deported. Anyway, that's how my career got started. And then from there to Embassy Pictures, Avco Embassy. I was in my early 20s, and I was the youngest foreign advertising and publicity marketing guy in the industry at the time. The closest guy to me was like 40. Mm-hmm. And I ran everything for his, The Graduate, The Line in Winter, the producers. Again, I didn't produce the films. I deal with the marketing and sale, all that kind of stuff. And I work for Joseph E. Levine at Embassy Pictures.
Wow. 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 And
that was another degree in showmanship.
Yeah.
And then it went on from there. And one thing led to another. Then when Reagan became president, this is too long a story to tell, but Reagan became president. His best friend was named Charles Z. Wick. Mm-hmm. And he hired me to be deputy director of the U.S. Information Agency Television and Film Service in Washington, where I had two broadcast television studios, 250 people working for me. And it was terrific. It was a great experience working for the government. Yeah. And then one day after I produced the last film I produced was The Life of Hal David, the Composer, Expressing a Feeling. It's on YouTube. A little choppy. The transfer was a little choppy, but it's on YouTube. It's Hal David. He was with Burt Bacharach.
Okay.
They were partners. Remember Raindrops Keep Falling on Your Head and all these other things. So I did that. And then I was working with a lot of people in private industry. One who was Leo Jaffe, who was former president of Columbia Pictures, mm-hmm. Jaffe name out there. And Leo said to me stuff like, when are you going back to private industry? And I said, well, I'm going to do it. And then I'm rolling these things together, but my wife's from Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, and I'm up there visiting. And my mother-in-law says, she didn't drive a car. She said, would you drive me out to this apple orchard? I want to see my friends. Okay, fine. So I go out there, and the father, the husband of the wife, says, I want you to meet my son. And I said, okay, why? He says, because you're driving a BMW 530i and you have holes in the bottom of your Gucci loafers. You got to meet my son. He's as crazy as you are. And I went, okay. And I met this guy, and he was working on a computer for young children. This is before the days of custom chips. Mm-hmm. They were large-scale integrated circuits there, or whatever. And he says to me, I'd like to hire you. I needed the money. I'd like to hire you to do a marketing study of this computer I'm putting together. So I did the marketing study. I made some money on it. He said to me, and I killed it for various reasons. And he said, well, this was money well spent. He was in the Futurist Society. Okay. The Futurist Society was run by Barbara Marx Hubbard. Her father, Marx, was Marx Toys. Mm-hmm. Louis Marx.
Incredible.
Incredible. So yeah. Barbara's running this with Scott and whatever. And they're way out there. Scott's telling me stories about one day you're going to have a computer on your wrist. You'll never write another check. But they were way out there. They knew what was coming. So he said, listen, you've saved me a lot of money, obviously, because, you know, what you've told me makes sense. Now, what do I do? And I said, where's the genius who put together? I'm a producer by trade. Producers bring talent together. Mm-hmm. That's what you do. So I said, where's the genius who did the computer? Well, I've hired him. He's in a garage in Silver Spring, Maryland, smoking up a storm, drinking coffee. And in his spare time, he fixes television sets. I said, I want to meet him. Mm-hmm. Do? Yeah. It's an interesting talent. I'd like to meet him. He goes, okay. So we go down to Maryland. We meet this guy. And in his office, there's this little airplane. In this area, he's not an office, this fix-it place. There's a little airplane. I said, what's that? Oh, it's a toy I made for myself. Really? What does it do? So he picks it up, and it accelerates, it decelerates, a little spaceship. Mm-hmm. I said, okay, I know what we're doing. He goes, what? I said, we're going in the toy business. He says, what do you know about the toy business? I said, absolutely nothing. But I'm a producer. Mm-hmm. It doesn't matter. I'll figure it out. This fellow named Mel Taft, he was executive vice president of R&D. Those were the days then when R&D was making decisions on product.
Yeah.
Not sales. Not marketing. Marketing might pick the color, mm-hmm. but it was R&D that was telling them what they were going to do. So I said, listen, I want to fly up and show you something, a product. I didn't say it was a toy. I didn't know toy and game. I didn't know the difference. So he says, okay, how could I not, you know, let's do it. Because he asked me my name and I said, forget my name. I said, you'll know my name if you want to do the product. Yeah. I'm only asking one thing of you. He said, what's that? That there's some decision makers if I'm going to spend the time and money to come up there. He said, oh, how could I pass this up? So I get on a plane, Scott and I fly to Bradley Field in Hartford, drive down to Milton, rent a car, drive down to Bradley. I show it to him. He goes, oh, you didn't know, but in World War II, I was a bomber pilot. And he starts doing touch and goes off the table. To make a long story short, they licensed it.
Wow.
And it became the number one toy. I didn't even know there was a toy fair. It became the number one toy at Toy Fair.
That's crazy, because Toy Fair is massive.
Oh, massive. This is when it was in 205th Avenue.
And so to not know, I mean, to not know anything about the toy industry, to not know a gaming company.
I didn't know one from another.
And then to go in.
I knew a great product when I saw it.
Which, that's a skill set all in itself.
Yeah, I think producers, that's part of what you do. You recognize talent.
Yeah.
And I said, this, look, it could have been something in the, it could have been in the medical field.
Mm-hmm.
I saw, it didn't have to be toys. It could have been anything. And if I got excited about it, I'd make it happen.
Also, but the reality that you at this point can just call a company and get a vice president on the phone to meet with you is so wild, because you, there's no way that could ever happen today.
Well, no one picks up phones today.
Right.
Forget about getting one. I got the president of Paramount International on the phone.
That's,
you wouldn't get through. You'd be in HR today. You'd be, you wouldn't even know I was around.
Yeah.
Today. But it was a different time.
What year would this toy have come out at Toy Fair?
Let's see. 19. I'm not very good at this. I'm not very good at tracking numbers in my career, to be honest.
Yeah.
But it would have been in the, I guess, the early 70s, sometime like that. I don't know. You'd have to check out it. You can find it online. Numbers, and they don't mean anything to me. I just, in fact, I said to him, he said, to show you how the industry used to be, he said to me, he says, how much do you want? And I knew how much I said to my partners, I said, how much should I get? Because I know in advance.
Yeah.
They gave me a number. And when you never negotiate against yourself. So you keep the number to yourself. You say, what do you want to give me? It was three times what I asked for. And then he said, I'm going to send you a letter with a check. And the letter is going to say, within 30 days, we'll agree to a contract. And I said, how do I know we're going to agree to a contract in 30 days? I don't want to take your money if we're not going to agree to a contract. And he said, we'll agree.
Mm-hmm.
I guarantee you we'll agree. And I said, and how can you be so sure? And he said, because I'm going to give you the same contract we give Marvin Glass.
Okay.
And I said, you know who that is?
Yeah.
A design studio in Chicago. And I said, who's Marvin Glass? He said, well, it's the number one toy design studio in the country, maybe in the world at that time.
Yeah.
And I'm giving you their contract because I think you're going to be a star one day in the business. And I want to give you the fairest contract there is. You know, pigs get fat, hogs get slaughtered. Contracts have to be win-win. And it was a win right from the beginning. And then we were off to the races.
That's incredible.
And it sold over 1 million units the first year.
Empire Blisters. Specializing in action figure blisters. 19 different styles. Two sizes of clamshell figure cases. Four different bulk pack options. Quantities of 100 sample packs available. Empire Blisters.
Now sponsor Toys on Tap.
That means a 10% off coupon on checkout. Use code Toys on Tap 10. That's TOYSOMTAP 10.
Empire Blisters.
Worldwide.
Yeah.
That's
no, I'm wrong. Sorry. Over 1 million units the first year in the United States. You bring up worldwide. I'll tell you why. It's an interesting story.
Yeah.
Scott, there were three of us. Scott says to me, he says, you know, Starbird's over now. We've sold 1 million and some units. We've all made money with it. I'd like to take my money and invest in something else, whatever he wanted to invest in. Would you buy me out? So I said, yeah. So he gave me a number and I bought him out of our contract with, you know, I took that. And then I evened up with my other partner to make sure he was, because I didn't want to, he was the electronic guy. I didn't want to, you know. So now life goes on and suddenly I get a check in the mail the next year. I said, wow, what is this for? Because I thought it was over at the United States. And I called up Taft and I said, Mel, I just got this check. What is this? He goes, oh, foreign. I said, foreign? He said, well, we sell all over the world. I said, you do? Where do you sell? And he gives me the list of countries. It's like amazing. So all of a sudden it started generating more income all over the world.
That's so crazy. So how long, I mean, with your long list of toys that you dabble in, how long are you actually in the toy industry?
45 years.
Okay. So 45 years, it all begins with this first toy.
Begins with this first toy. And it became the number one toy at Toy Fair.
Yeah.
And I also had well, many years later, I had the number one game at Toy Fair one year.
Tell me about that game.
It's called, well, it was called, in fact, I have a copy of it here. Let's see if I can get it down. But I called it Ad Infinitum. It ultimately became Advertising.
Okay.
And every company turned it down. Every single game company. Now I know the difference between toys and games. Mm-hmm. Every company turned it down. And I finally said, you know, I saw this company in Chicago called, my motto is never give up, never grow up. So I don't give up on this stuff. Mm-hmm. So I put it in the mail to a company in Chicago called Catico Games. Week or so later, I get a phone call. We want to do it. So really? Yeah. That game went on to sell over 1 million units the first year. And it was my first game. Now, this game I did by, I collaborate on a lot of products, but this one I did myself. Mm-hmm. It was, we did it as a family, my wife, my daughter, and myself. It was terrific. I said to the president, I said, I'm really thrilled that you want to do it. I said, but it's not quite ready for prime time. I want to do some fine tuning of the game. And he goes, well, chief, he used to call people he liked chief. Yeah. He said, well, chief, you've got a choice. I said, what's that? He says, we can sell 1 million Fords, or we can wait for a Lincoln. I said, you know, I drive a Mustang. I like Fords. And we were off to the races.
Yeah.
And it was called, they changed the name to Advertising from Ad Infinitum.
Yeah. As you continued, do you find that throughout your toy career, you dabbled more in the finding of talent or in the inventing part of the games and toys?
Both. I never, I don't represent people.
Okay.
I'm not an agent for people. Don't call me. You got an idea, run with it. But I do have a group that I work with, and I'm always very involved. It's either, you know, if it's my idea, I may call a friend with golden hands, because I don't have golden hands. Mm-hmm. I may go ahead. You want to go together on this and work, and we'll do some, you know, that kind of way. But I've never been hung a shingle out and said, I'm going to be an agent. But if yeah. I see, some, look, even the biggest invention firms, you know, like the Glasses or whomever, well, they're not around now, but any of these guys that are engineers or whatever and have their own companies, if somebody stumbles through the door or they see something, they'll partner up with them.
Yeah.
You know,
let's move up to the 90s and kind of circle around the toy that, like, I grew up with. It shocked the world and what it was, because it was so inventive and new for its time. Oh, I kind of want to talk to you about the Furby.
I call it the beloved creature.
The beloved creature. From all research on this, you somehow got wrapped up in this and saw it in its like infant stages of basically being a tennis ball covered in fur.
Yeah, it had to be puppeteered. Yeah.
Yeah. So tell me, can you walk me through the process of how did you even get to have your hands on this product or project before anyone else was there? Like, how did you get your name in the ring?
Okay, so I had done work a couple of years earlier for a fellow at Mattel. His wife was doing some project up in Seattle, mm-hmm. with paper origami. I don't really, it's foggy now. But they needed help with marketing, pulling it all together and whatever. So somebody at Mattel recommended me to this guy, and I told his wife I'd be happy to help him. So I did what I did, and they were very grateful for the advice I gave them. And he said to me, what do I owe you? And I said, nothing. Yeah, but you put all this time in. I said, yeah, but I don't work by the hour. I'm not a lawyer. I don't. You know, an engineer who works by the hour. I said, pass it forward. Mm-hmm. I said, just pass it forward. So, okay. So I guess a while later, I don't know how long it was, because again, I don't follow timelines. I get this phone call. This guy recommended me to Dave Hampton and Caleb Chung. They were mm-hmm. working on this project together. And they called me up and described it and said, we'd like you to join us and make this thing happen. They had been to two other companies and they were turned down for whatever reason. It doesn't matter. It's, you know, that means nothing. Rejection in this industry is, you know, you can't take it seriously.
Yeah.
It's just, for me, it's a rehearsal before the big event.
Yeah.
Somebody says no to me, it just means not now.
I am going to write that down because that's a really good quote. Rejection is just the rehearsal
before the big event.
Yeah.
And no, no means not now in my vocabulary. So I get this call and I fly to California, meet with them. And I said, well, there's only one company that's going to do this. So what do you mean? I said, Tiger Electronics in Chicago. Mm-hmm. I said, very friendly with them. I licensed some games to them in the past. And I knew Roger Shiftman, should rest in peace. I knew him forever.
Yeah.
So I called Roger. I said, Roger, I want you to see something. He said, I'm going to be in LA next week. I said, oh, that's perfect. I said, I'm going to have Dave and Kev come over and show you something. Okay, I'm at this hotel. He calls me the day before and he says to me, look, he said, I can't see them. What do you mean you can't see them? He's hecking into a handkerchief. He says, I'm sick. He says, I'm so sick, I'm canceling my trip to Hong Kong and I'm going back to Chicago. Yeah. Remember, I know this is the only company that can get this done. And Hasbro, Mattel, they would never move it. You know, I have a sign in my office. You can't see it, but it says, thou shalt not committee. What you're dealing with there is, you know, the process.
Yeah.
And you know, these guys like Galoob toys. They were cowboys. They could make decisions at a moment's notice. So I said, Roger, how many years have I known you? Sometimes you got to call an audible, throw the Hail Mary. I said, how many years have I known you? 25, 30? I don't. I said, yeah, that's about right. I said, have I ever wasted your time? Not that he took everything, but have I ever wasted your time? No, of course not. I said, okay, I want you to do, I said, are you on your deathbed? I'm not on my deathbed. I've got a cold. Yeah, I got a bad cold. I said, do this for me. See it. And I didn't go through the inventor relations departments because this thing was so sophisticated potentially that I couldn't rely on somebody else presenting this. I had to make the presentation.
Yeah. Can I ask you a quick question? Yeah. At this point, Tiger Electronics, if I can remember correctly, they were dabbling in handheld video games that were very rudimentary.
Yeah, but they were, they had the setup in China to make this stuff.
Yeah. And Furby is so advanced for its time.
Yes.
So for Tiger Electronics, this was just your go-to. You knew they could.
I just had a vibe that this was the place. And they're really entrepreneurial.
Okay.
I mean, very entrepreneurial. So, and I'll get into that sophistication in a minute.
Yeah.
So I said, do it for me. I'll do it. So now they come to the door of the hotel. I wasn't there, but I was told, you know, he's sneezing. He's in his boxer shorts and t-shirt, the way I understand it. And he sees it and he calls me. He says, what's next? Well, what's next is, no, he said, I'm busy, this and that. I said, right, look, if you're busy, that's fine. You got to see this thing now. I want to get this thing rolling. He says, okay, come to Chicago. I said, fine. Get us all tickets based on what you saw and we'll come to Chicago. He goes, fine. We go to Chicago. We're sitting in a meeting with everybody in the company and demonstrating this. Randy Rissman, who owned Tiger Electronics, says to me, so who's going to do these electronics? They're very sophisticated. And I said, Dave Hampton, he'll do it. I remember, I haven't known Dave a long time, but I knew his reputation. Dave, genius, an absolute genius. And I said, Dave will do it. Nobody programs like Dave. Nobody writes code like Dave. Nobody, whatever. Okay, who's going to do the mechanism? I said, Caleb will do the mechanism. If he can't do it, I've got my partner, Richard Maddox, that'll do it. Okay, what about the design? I said, they've never done a doll kind of thing before. I said, I know all kinds of doll designers. And this was really on my reputation.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they didn't know these guys from Adam. And they decided, they said, okay, we're going to do it. And that's how it got off the ground. And in the end, Richard Maddox did the mechanism. Dave did all the electronics and everything else. And, you know, and we licensed it to Tiger.
Yeah. And it's such a unique, I could get why they would be.
Three-dimensional Tamagotchi.
Yeah.
I mean, the difference was Tamagotchi would die if you didn't feed it, and Furby farted.
Yeah. And what was so, I get why they would have reservations, because though it looks like a doll, there's a whole body in there and the skin is just laid over it, basically.
Yeah, exactly. And I'll tell you something. The good fortune we had was that it wasn't a Mattel and it wasn't a Hasbro. And the reason I say that is, that's not knocking these companies, mm-hmm. but they would have had a million people with their fingers in the pie. Mm-hmm. And basically Tiger let us do what we had to do. You know, Dave didn't want an on-off switch.
Yeah.
To come alive when you picked it up. So that was a battle we won.
Yeah.
We won. Didn't have an off. You think Hasbro or these come to, well, yeah, they'll do a study on it. You got to have an on-off switch. You know, that kind of stuff. I mean, we were just allowed to do it. And I'll tell you something. Every time I picked up the phone and called Randy Rissman for something we needed, picked up the phone immediately. There was never a question. Just picked up the phone.
Yeah.
And I even said to Roger once, I said, Roger, I got to know something. Because I said, you know, business is not about transactions with Richard Levy. It's about relationships. And I want to make sure that you guys don't get screwed on this thing. How many do we have to sell for you to be a hero at the company? Mm-hmm. And he said, if we do 250,000 units the first year, I'm golden.
You did like...
We did 4 million the first
year. Yeah.
And now why do we do 4 million? Because Randy knew coming out of Toy Fair that he had Walmart for 1 million units. Mm-hmm. And he said, boy, this thing could really fly. See, when Tickle Me Elmo hit, and it was a big success, but they weren't prepared with product. Mm-hmm. They ran through, say they had 900,000 units, whatever they had, they ran through it. He wanted to make sure that we always had, I mean, KB Toys at the time had an open purchase order for 25,000 units a week until wow. further notice, a week. And the second year, Roger told me that we sold one Furby every minute worldwide for the 6 weeks leading up to Christmas, 24/7. Every minute you're selling a Furby.
Richard, that's an insane statistic.
Insane statistic. It's like craziness.
What's interesting? Yeah.
Well, I was going to tell you. So why did we have so much product? Mm-hmm. Because Randy multi-tooled the product. He went to 5 different factories and had them. I was in China. I saw it. Imagine a factory doing nothing but Furbies. Every floor was making a different Furby.
Yeah.
And, he took that risk. He took that risk and it paid off.
Yeah. Did your role, I mean, as Tiger Electronics license it, what is your role in this? Are you working with?
I worked with everybody. I kept the train on the, I mean, Tiger had the confidence. They always came to me for stuff. Now, Dave was the genius with the electronics and Richard was doing the mechanism and all that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. But I took a cruise once over Thanksgiving with my family, and I said to Stuart Sims, who was executive vice president of marketing, I said, listen, I'm going to be away for Thanksgiving.
We interrupt this broadcast of Toys on Tap to bring you this. Meanwhile, in a galaxy of bootleg treasures.
DOV2, we have engine failure. We must crash land on DKE Toy Planet.
Oh my, we're doomed.
Wait, salvation. Hooray, we're saved, DOV2. Limited edition custom artist-made action figures and DKE toys.
Check out www.dketoys.com for a full catalog.
Hooray for custom action figures.
DKE.
I said, there were no cell phones. When I get on the ground, I'll call in to my guys from a cell phone and report back how things are going. He goes, why wouldn't you call me from the ship? I said, it's $35 a minute from the ship. He goes, we'll pay it. Make your calls.
Yeah.
That was it. I mean, that was my, you know what I mean? I just kind of kept it rolling. And I remember near the end when we had a droopy eyelid on the toy right before code release.
Mm-hmm.
And Roger's screaming, release the code. And I said, Roger, we have a droopy eyelid. He goes, listen, am I going to sell one more Furby because of a droopy eyelid? Can't we make a running change? And I said, you'll sell more than one more if the eyes are right. And he goes, okay, take the time you need. I mean, that was, you know what I mean? But, and I negotiated the contract and I found Tiger and I kept it on the, you know, and I took ownership of it like I would have anything.
Yeah. Furby is so intriguing to me because it was so far ahead of its time. And people don't realize that it was so far that it was starting to scare people. There was a release that came out where it was banned from high level government buildings because they thought
NSA banned it. Well, you couldn't make this stuff up. I mean, every time, I'm not saying Furby sales tailed off, mm-hmm. but every time Furby kind of, all of a sudden the NSA bans it. And by the way, we were on like Jay Leno, the Today Show, multiple times.
Yeah.
Not just once, multiple times. I mean, this was real. We, at least talking for myself, I was so busy doing what I was doing that I didn't really pay attention to all what was going on around it for a while. We were so busy getting it off the ground and everything else. But it was amazing. I mean, that first day at FAO, when they premiered it, they had to make it two per customer. And it was crazy. And then listen, you'll love this. So inside of Furby is a Mabuchi motor,
mm-hmm.
Japanese motors. And this is how decisions were made. This sums it up. And this would never happen at a big company. So Randy orders, he wants to order 1 million units to start. And he gets a call from Japan, from either the owner or the chairman or the president of Mabuchi, saying, listen, what you're doing with the motors, which is this, we don't do that. Our motors go like this. The way the wires are wound inside, we go in one direction. Mm-hmm. So I can't guarantee 1 million motors. Randy calls me. He says, they won't guarantee the motors. Ask Dave what he thinks. So I called Dave in California. I said, Dave, they won't guarantee the motors. Randy wants your advice. Tell him to buy them. And the reason, he says, because for the last 6 weeks or months, whatever it was, I've been puppeteering these things with puppeteers from Sid and Marty Croft, if you remember them.
Yeah.
And they've been going back and forth, and we've never lost a single motor. So just pour them. And Randy orders them. I mean, that was the way it went.
Yeah.
Very entrepreneurial.
At what point in this process did you pull away from Furby and move to your next project?
Well, it was kind of interesting.
I
haven't really talked about this, but I created a game called Men Are From Mars, Women Are From Venus
mm-hmm.
during the time I was working on Furby. And I licensed it to Mattel. And at the same toy fair, that's quite a story, but at the same toy fair that Furby was premiering and setting the world on fire,
mm-hmm.
I had Men Are From Mars over at Mattel.
Okay.
So I had the number one adult social interactive game and the number one toy at simultaneously.
That's an insane year.
But the Men Are From Mars story is crazy. So I noticed in the newspaper in the press, John Gray had just done a 2-hour Barbara Walters special
mm-hmm.
and Time Magazine had given him like 7 pages
of
his relationship work.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, wow, Men Are From Mars. So I contact HarperCollins, his publisher, tell him who I am. And they said, well, we don't have the rights. You're going to have to talk to Dr. Gray himself. Okay. Do you have a phone number? He lives in Marin. Here's his phone number. So outside of San Francisco. So I call him up. Hello. I said, listen, my name is Richard Levy. I'm a very prominent toy and game inventor. I'd like to do a game based on Men Are From Mars. He goes, what's the deal? How do you want to work? So I told him what the deal was. He said, okay, we can do that. I said, but I got to talk to my lawyer first. Okay, what am I going to say? So I hang up the phone. I said to my wife, Cheryl, we're dead. What do you mean? It's not going to happen. He's talking to his lawyer.
Mm-hmm.
Lawyers kill deals. They don't make deals. They kill deals. He goes, she goes, well, you know, you gave it a shot. Phone rings 10 minutes later. Richard, it's John. I said, hey, John. He goes, listen, my lawyer's in Europe for 2 weeks. I can't reach him. I can't get him. I said, well, here's the story. I said, the time is now, and I'm the man. I said, if we don't do it now, you know, never get caught with your trends down. Mm-hmm. I said, you know, it's like the fashion industry. So I said, we have to do it now or we're not going to do it at all. And he says to me, oh, and I said, call the CEO of any toy company and give them my name. See what they think. Call Mattel, call Hasbro, call this one, call that one. He goes, I like the sound of this. Let's do it. I said, okay. So ultimately, Mattel licenses it.
Mm-hmm.
And we fly to their headquarters in El Segundo. And I had never met John before.
Yeah.
And the stretch limo pulls up in front of the building. And out comes John. And, oh, he says to me at one point, what about the contract between us? I said, John, if we waste time with lawyers doing a contract between us, let's do a handshake. He goes, we'll do it. Nicest guy,
yeah.
Just terrific guy. So we went upstairs and we had a conference room filled with Mattel executives with their books to be signed and everything else. It was really nice. And at one point, Tim Kilpin, who's now president of Hasbro, he says to me, how are we going to work on this with you and John? Who do we talk to? Well, having worked at Paramount and Embassy Pictures with movie stars,
mm-hmm.
I knew that if I turned the company loose on John, the deal would be over. They drive him crazy because that's just the nature of the beast.
Mm-hmm.
So I crossed these fingers under the table, his hand, and I said, remember, I only know John 5 minutes. And I said, everybody works through me. And I'm waiting, one Mississippi, two Mississippi. What's going to happen with John? He stands up. He puts his right hand on my left shoulder and he says, everybody works through Richard.
Yeah.
And we were off to the races and we did a game that sold over 1 million units the first year.
You have a super success with the number million, which is incredible.
I have many more scars than medals. Trust me.
Yeah.
Scars than medals, but I have had I've been very lucky.
Yeah,
very lucky. What I've worked on and picked to work on and whatever.
With these successes, at some point you produced a book.
Yes. Well, that happened. Yeah, the first book. I've been writing books anyway myself.
Yeah.
And Ron Weingartner, who was associate vice president of product development at Milton Bradley, called me up.
Mm-hmm.
We're friends. And he said, listen, I want to write a book on inventors.
Yeah.
And he said, who but you to write it with?
Yeah.
Not only are you a writer, but you have all the connections with the publishers and you're an inventor and blah, blah, blah. So I said, I think it's a great idea. So I got off the phone. I said to Cheryl, Ron wants to write a book on toy inventors. I'll be Mr. Outside. He'll be Mr. Inside. In other words, the company's I was Mr. Inside. The companies talked to me, not to him, because he was an executive at Milton Bradley. He had permission to write it. And the inventors would talk to him. They weren't going to be comfortable talking to me because I'm a competitive inventor. So we did that. And Cheryl says to me, who's going to write the book? And I said, well, we'll co-author it. He goes, not so fast. I want to know he can write. Because you're not going to write the book. And I would, just because somebody has an idea, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I said, okay, so I call Ron up. I said, Ron, do me a favor. Write me the introduction to the book so I can see your writing skills. I know you're brilliant with engineering and this and that. He wrote something that was just cherry. It was just right on. I said, this guy can write. And we were off to the races. I found a publisher. And then we spun it off into other books. And we're still very close friends today. I just saw him a couple of weeks ago in New England. And that's how the book happened.
Yeah. And to be a part of a book, it's is it called the thousand or selling your inventions?
Well, no, that's, I've done several books. I've done
okay.
My first book was called Richard C. Levy's Secrets to Selling Inventions.
Yeah.
I self-published it. It's a long story. I did very well with it, actually. And then I did other books along the way. And I used to write for magazines and newspapers. I've had a cover story on Parade Magazine. You don't remember Parade Magazine, but it was
amazing. Yeah, that was before my time.
Back in the day, it was in every newspaper in the country. And anyway, I wrote for United Press International. And just, I love the, but I'll tell you how I got it. Writing was always going to be my backup, mm-hmm. because my uncle's best, his roommate, my uncle, the producer, he produced Come Blow Your Horn on Broadway and a whole bunch of other stuff. And his college roommate at Dartmouth was a writer who was responsible for many shows, but one of them, either Search for Tomorrow or one of the big General Hospital, I don't know, one of the big, I think it was on CBS, a big soap opera. One day we were in Bernardsville, New Jersey, walking through his house, and he points to a chalet behind his house. It's interesting how things happen. This is almost like how I got Emerson tapping the guy, you know?
Yeah.
And we go into this house, and he points to an IBM correcting Selectric typewriter on the desk. Remember those with the ball in it?
Oh, yeah.
And I said, and he says to me, that's where the money's made. And a light bulb went off. I said, say that again. He said, that's where the money's made. Writing. And I went, wow. So we get home and I said to my wife, buy an IBM correcting Selectric. They might have been a couple $1,000. I don't know what they were, expensive typewriters in those days. Let's buy one. And then I started coming up with ideas for magazine articles. Mm-hmm. And I started selling them. Not making a lot of money, but selling them. And I always felt that I could fall back on writing. And you know, when you look at the credit crawl on a television show,
yeah,
whether it's Friends or any of these shows, and you see all these associate producers, they're all writers. Mm-hmm. They're writers of the show. Walter Cronkite, Dan, all these in the past, these anchors, they all started off working for the Associated Press writing. Mm-hmm. In fact, when I ran the television studio, I used to say to everybody I interviewed for a job, let me see a writing sample. Mm. Most people never came back. One guy came back. One guy said to me, well, I write poetry. And I said, good, I want to read your poetry. He goes, nobody wants to read my poetry. Yeah. I said, well, Richard C. Levy wants to read your poetry. So he sends me his poetry. I said, you're hired. I am? Based on my poetry? I said, yeah, you're a huge talent. He goes, what do you want me to do? I said, well, we review films for American embassies all over the world. Mm-hmm. I want you to sit in screening rooms, watching movies, and reviewing the films. Who better than a poet to distill the plot of a film and put it into the fewest words, into cables? Isn't that interesting?
That's, you know, a very good way to look at that.
Yeah, I said, no, you're a poet, man. I mean, you paint pictures, you do this and that. I don't want some guy just throwing out a lot of words just to give me 20 graphs. I want, yeah, the whole thing done in a couple of graphs. So anyway, writing was always a very important thing. And I bring writing into my games and my toys. I'm still very much a writer. I think the written word is, even today with emails and everything, it's even more critical.
Yeah. So after all this and coming up to like modern day, where do you find yourself in this industry? Are you still actively this producer type role looking for toys and games and writing and things?
I'm not looking for them as much as creating them with friends.
Okay.
I've got a bunch of friends. They have golden hands.
Yeah.
They've been around a long time, like me, been around, yeah, a long time. And we're having a lot of fun. In fact, my new game, well, these are some interesting stories. So this is a very cool story. Can you see Brain Bolt?
Oh, I've seen Brain Bolt.
One day at Toy Fair, a fellow comes up to me. His name's Brad Ross. And he says to me, I've read your books. Would you like to collaborate? I said, you know how many times people say this to me, you can't imagine. So I said, thanks for the nice comment on my book. And life goes on. A couple of years go by and I'm on the street in New York. I'm on the streets in New York doing something. My daughter lives in New York. She's also a producer, by the way. Mm-hmm. And she's in the music business. And so I run into him on the street. Come on, you got to come over to my apartment. So I figured this is beshert. It's a Yiddish word for meaning fate, destiny.
Yeah.
This is meant to be. So I, Cheryl and Betty were busy with something. So I said, yeah, I'll go over and see this guy. So I walk into his apartment and there are games piled up to the ceiling. And I looked at them and I go, boy, you've been very productive, but you haven't made a dime. Mm-hmm. He goes, that's right. Because I can tell they're European companies and whatever. He says, but let me show you one other product. So he pulls out a product called Optix, O-P-T-I-X. And I said, and what is it? And he shows me how it works. And it was an electronic, you know, follow the light game, whatever, memory game. And I said, how did it do in England? And he said, it was only in England. He said 130,000 units. Like, that's huge. Mm-hmm. Now, one thing I didn't tell you about me, I love to create games, mm-hmm. but I don't like to play games. I consider myself a test pilot.
Yeah.
In other words, I'll make the airplane airworthy, but I'm not going back and forth between LAX and JFK. Mm-hmm. That's not going to happen. But I pick up this Optix game and I can't put it down. And I said to him, Brad, I said, I told what I just told you. I said, I love games. I'm a passion for games. But don't call me up and say, bring over one of your games. Of course, mm-hmm. they always expect me to win. So I said, I know exactly what to do with this. Do you want to go into partnership? Go, yeah, let's do it. So I called up Lisa Julie, the president of Educational Insights. And I said, I'm hooked. She goes, if you're that hooked, send it to my house. Mm-hmm. So I sent it to my house. She goes, I love it. Let me put it into the system. Well, you know what happens when things go into the system.
Yeah.
She calls me up. She says, I'm sorry, but it's been rejected for whatever. It doesn't matter the reasons. Well, I'm very busy. A year goes by. I'm at Toy Fair. And Lisa says to me, well, whatever happened to Optix? And I said, oh, I said, I've been so busy. I still love it. But she goes, we have a new head of product development. Mm-hmm. Owe it to her. If she likes it, we'll do it. Because she says, it's been on my mind ever since. Mm-hmm. I said, terrific. And I said to this woman, I said, Bettina, her name was Bettina. I said, Bettina, you're going to be up against the same headwinds. Don't worry. I'm in charge. And if I like it, we'll do it. Well, make a long story short, we're now on our third SKU. We have Brain Bolt. We have Brain Bolt Boost. We have Brain Bolt Genius. And we're working on some other stuff. And it's a real hit with the company.
Wow.
And the sky's the limit. But I recognized it.
You have, from all the things that I've heard in all aspects of your life, you have a keen eye to see success before anyone else does.
Well, that's very nice of you. I don't know. I just do what I do.
Yeah.
But and I'm not afraid to change directions. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I have to shift or whatever. But this is quite this again, never give up, never grow up. I mean, if I believe in something, unless somebody shows me a fatal flaw. Mm-hmm. Here's another one of my videos.
Okay.
Tightrope.
Yeah.
You take elastics, you build patterns, and then you balance your marbles.
Okay.
It's doing incredibly well. In fact, it's on the cover of the Mindwear Fall catalog mm-hmm. for this year. That's how well it's doing.
Wow.
I did this with my buddy Peter, who's a former senior vice president of R&D at Fisher Price.
Wow.
And we're very close friends and we do stuff together. And we're motivated by the money, don't get me wrong.
Yeah.
But it's also keeping this going.
Yeah. At this point, you're at a point in your life which seems so fun because it's for fun to just tinker and do things and invent things with friends. And does that change how free it is to move through all these different hoops now that you're just doing it? Okay.
I've always had a passion for doing this. Every product, every one of my successful products broke rules. Like, for example, when I went to Milton Bradley with Men Are From Mars and then Mattel, you know, Milton Bradley said, books don't make games. Books don't make games. Books don't make games. Oh, really? Okay. Or how about this one? Safety doesn't sell. I mean, they come up with this stuff in businesses, all businesses.
Yeah.
The key is none of my products that has been, not, no successful product was ever on a corporate wish list.
Hmm.
They know it when they see it. But it's not like I'm looking at a wish list.
Yeah.
Now, if I look at a wish list and say they want adult social interactive games, that's fine. I understand. That's good advice. But no product of mine that's been successful has ever been on a wish list. Milton Bradley didn't know an electronic airplane was coming down the line.
Yeah.
You know, Mattel didn't know, but whatever the product is.
Yeah, that's true.
Fun challenge. I've never been motivated by money. You know, the old cliche, you come up shortchanged if you're motivated by money. But it's always been the challenge. It's always been the challenge. And the harder the challenge, as far as I'm concerned, the better it is, because it keeps the, you know, people say if it's not broken, don't break it.
Mm-hmm.
I say if it's not broken, break it.
Because
your competitor will.
Yeah.
Ultimately, they will. So the harder it is to get something into production and get the cost or anything else. See, anyway, that's kind of like the way I look at things.
It's, yeah.
You know, I take ownership of everything. And at the end of the day, if there are three products in front of a company, because I always believe you're selling yourself first.
Mm-hmm.
Before the product, you're selling yourself. If there's three products on the table and they're all what they call prime center pares, first among equals, I want them to say, let's go with Richard. He's always there.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. Has your relationship or dynamic shifted throughout the years with all these toy companies as they start to evolve and change?
Well, what happened, it's any industry.
Yeah.
I mean, I talked to you once about early on in this about my friend Leo Jaffe, who was chairman of Columbia Pictures. And one day he came to me and he asked me to do something for him. And I said, Leo, you're Bridge Over the River Kwai. You're Lawrence of Arabia.
Yeah.
You're former chairman of Columbia Pictures, on the board of directors of Coca-Cola. I mean, you need me? And he said to me, they don't know who I am anymore.
Oh, no.
Well, but this happens in every industry.
Yeah.
You know, in some ways, we're dinosaurs in the 20s. Yeah. Young people coming up.
Yeah.
They're in their 20s. They don't have a sense of history. They don't know who Marvin Glass was, Eddie Goldfarb, Richard Lee, whomever. I mean, she says, no, they don't know who I am. And I remember my uncle came to me once to get tickets for something. I said, Uncle Mike, you're a Broadway producer. You're partners with Jimmy Hammerstein. You're Neil Simon. You're this, that. You need me? He goes, they don't know who I am.
Mm-hmm.
Think about industries. It's generations of people. They come, they go, they die, they, you know, and nobody knows who you are.
Wow. Richard, thank you so much for coming on Toys on Tap today.
Well, I appreciate your interest and hope to meet you in person one day.